I'm Doug Wells.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Many people around the world spend their lives in an Apple environment. We wake to an alarm on our iPhone. We immediately check our emails on that same phone, which we stare at much of the day. We track our exercise on our Apple Watch, and we conduct business with our iPads and Macs. The richness of the Apple product line has driven it to become one of the most admired and valuable companies in the world.
But there's no question that the most important factor driving Apple to extraordinary heights was the presence of its founder, Steve Jobs. And the company has changed in some very material ways since his death in 2011. The story of how Apple has evolved since then is laid out in compelling detail in Trip Mickle's new book, After Steve, How Apple Became a Trillion-Dollar Company and Lost Its Soul. We're very lucky to have Mr. Mickle with us this morning. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
So much for having me.
Trip, can you start by giving us a little bit of background on what motivated you to write the book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
I spent several years covering Apple, first at the Wall Street Journal, and now I'm with the New York Times. And early in my tenure at the Journal, two things jumped out at me. One was just in meeting with people who had worked at Apple or worked at Apple, it was clear that there was still grief when it came to talking about Steve Jobs and his death. And that was something I'd not come across in any of my business coverage in the past. And I wanted to learn more about that. And then layered on top of that was the fact that this figure at Apple who's really critical to every project and product that they've made over time, Johnny Ive, the chief design officer, was dealing with grief in a way that had led him to kind of pull back from the company and be less engaged and less involved. And I wanted to know more about why that happened. And the combination of those two questions were what really propelled my research into this book project.
Yeah, and it plays out in a fascinating story in your book. And we're going to get to some of these points, but I want to start with if you can share some context by describing a bit about how Jobs managed Apple and how his role in driving its extraordinary products. Can you share a bit about how key and central he was?
I mean, he was the sun which all of Apple revolved around. He was a uniquely talented individual and was able to structure the company in a way that no one else could structure a company in the world, in part because He occupied several different chief roles for the company that would typically at other companies be occupied by other people. He was essentially the chief marketing officer, the chief design officer. He was the chief technology officer. And then, of course, he was the chief executive officer. And in each of those roles, he was able to direct product as it was developed. He was the one who was essentially the midwife for everything that Apple made. He sat at the center of the company, and the spokes of the wheel that were off that nerve center himself kind of flowed into him, and he was able to connect what software was doing with what design was doing with what hardware was doing to make the products that we know and love today.
And what was so extraordinary, you know, as I was reading the book and thinking about it, was the way he would anticipate a product and what it would be in a vision that really is unparalleled. One of the things I wanted that the book sort of brings to mind, I think lots of people know about Jobs and the fact that he would envision something like an iPhone before anybody else would even think of it. But the other thing that I've always known about Apple products is that when I open the box, the packaging is amazing. Everything about it is completely well thought out. And Apple produced products that were not only extraordinary from a technical perspective, but were really museum-quality design industrial artwork. Talk to us a little bit about Johnny Ive and his role in that.
Yeah, Johnny Ive was central to that, and the book is sort of doubles as a biography of Johnny Ive and Tim Cook, the chief executive officer, who I'm sure we'll get to later. But Johnny, for his part, when you talk about the packaging, that was something that goes back for him all the way back to his early days as a designer in London when he was doing a spec project for Apple, and this is part of the reason they hired him. He was brought on to design a laptop for the company. He did the project, developed the prototype, put it in a box, and then wrapped it in tissue paper, plus put a sticker on top with his design firm's logo, Tangerine, and then layered in t-shirts and packed it all up. This was contrary to how most people at that time, this is in the early 1990s, sent off finished work to whoever they were fulfilling the work for. You know, when this package arrived from Johnny, Apple opened it, it just had a touch of sophistication that they didn't get from others. And so they hired Johnny to join the firm, and he brought that kind of packaging ethos to Apple over the years and really perfected it. And they put as much time into how a box, the tightness with which a box kind of opens and kind of it kind of, you can feel the air kind of flow out of it as you pull an iPhone top of an iPhone box open. And that was really Johnny's brilliance and what he brought to it, and just the specifications that he made sure that Apple abided by when it made not only the iPhone itself, but the packaging that the iPhone came in.
You know, many of the audience knows the story of Steve Jobs and his background, his father being a carpenter, and that teaching Steve the value of details and craftsmanship. Many of us, I didn't know Johnny Ive's background until I read your book. Tell us a little bit about his background. How did he develop that sharp taste for design?
Johnny's in some ways one of many prodigies that Steve Jobs collected around him to do his bidding in various areas of the business. And Johnny grew up outside of London. His father was an industrial designer by training who taught industrial design in high school. And so Johnny grew up, the book details one of these early moments where his father was teaching what we would call in the U.S. shop, where he had taken on a project to teach students, high school students, how to make a hovercraft. And so they were spending the better part of a year on this. And at the age of four, Johnny was perpetually in the design studio in the workshop, surveying the work that they were doing, and students would say that he would just come by and stand and watch as they custom made a propeller and just stare at it with the same kind of focus that the average four-year-old would bring to cartoons on a Saturday morning. And Johnny, to his credit, recalls this as some of his earliest memories of design and the making of things. And so his father really encouraged that interest of his, and over time Johnny developed both artistic sensibilities. He had a gift for drawing and a gift for making and a passion for making. His Christmas present every year from his father was the chance to go with his father and work in his father's design shop. By this point he was working at a college, and Johnny could go and make whatever he wanted so long as he drew it beforehand. So his father really nurtured the skill and talent. And by the time Johnny got to college, he was just far and away superior in terms of his skill level to many of his peers. And this was at a very sophisticated design school that produced some of the greatest industrial design talent in the world. And that's why he went on to Apple and did so many great things.
I want to sort of get on to the relationship between Jobs and Johnny Ive. But first, I think it'd be useful for the audience to get just one or two more examples of the meticulousness that Ive brought. One of the things that struck me in the book was the way he looked at the raw manufacture of aluminum as part of their products, or the way he looked at the number of degrees in a curve on an iPhone. Can you give us a couple examples like that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, big picture, one of the things that I left the book project wondering about is, does Johnny Ive essentially have X-ray vision? Does he see the world in a way that we don't? Can he see, essentially, like, if he looked at you, could he see your skeletal system in a way that we just see flesh and muscle? There's a great scene in the book where he's seated at a long steel bar inside an airport. It's a metal bar, not steel, but it's just silver metal from one end to the other, 30 feet long. He's sitting there with a colleague, and he looks down at the bar and looks at the colleague and says, "I can see every seam in this bar." And the colleague looks at him and says, "Your life must be miserable," because he looks at it and he can only see just kind of silver metal from one end to the other. And that's just the kind of the eye that Johnny had. And so he brought that to bear in Apple in various ways. You mentioned the curvature. He was very focused on doing what is called Bezier curves. And you can't really see this on the iPhone, but it has more points in the curve than you typically would see in a curve, which would be like about 4 points. It has closer to a dozen points. And that's why those curves are perfectly sculpted and rounded. And that's the kind of sophistication that he brings to a product that goes often unnoticed, but is part of the reason that we gravitate to these devices.
You know, you have everybody in the studio pulling out their phones and checking the curves on their phone. What a wonderful story. Great explanation of Johnny and his influence on Apple. And let's talk about the death of Steve Jobs and how the company reacted to it.
Yeah, I mean, it was paralyzing. I mean, it was honestly paralyzing. Even though they had known for years that Jobs was very sick with cancer, and that the end was coming, and that Jobs was laying the foundation for the company to continue. I mean, he had spent a lot of time in preparation for his own death studying other companies that had struggled after the death of their founder. He looked at Sony, he looked at Polaroid, death and or departure of their founder in the case of Polaroid, and Disney in particular. And one of the things he didn't want the company to do after he died was do what the Walt Disney Company did after Walt Disney died, and that was ask what would Walt do. That set a precedent that resulted in years of stagnation at the Disney Company. It wasn't until Eisner arrived that they really shook themselves free of that and began making animated pictures again that were of the same quality that they'd made in the Walt Disney years. Jobs didn't want that. And yet, it's impossible after losing somebody that was really the inspiration for people coming to work, it's impossible for that not to set in. In fact, it was even more impossible at Apple because the company was going through this tremendous period of growth concurrently with the timing of Steve Jobs' death. The iPhone, at the time of his death, they were making about 20 million units of the iPhone a year. They now make upwards of 200 million. And so the company was adding a tremendous amount of staff. So people in the wake of his death were driving to campus to park and having to park, you know, blocks away and then walk to the office. It became, in a way, a company that was unrecognizable to some people, in part because Jobs wasn't there and in part because it was just growing at such a fast clip that they were no longer sitting in meetings that were the same size that they once were under Jobs.
So Cook was the successor handpicked by Jobs. Can we talk a little bit about Tim Cook's skill set and how his values and approach differed so much from Jobs?
Yeah. I mean, the book is a bit of a contrast between Tim Cook and Johnny Ive in a way, because Tim Cook grew up in Robertsdale, Alabama. It's a small town about an hour outside of Mobile, very, very much in the south of Alabama. And he grew up with a father who worked hard on the docks in Mobile. And he grew up looking at what his dad did and the hard work that he had to do and saying, oh, I want kind of a different life for myself. And he wound up at Auburn University, where he studied industrial engineering, which is a really interesting degree that I didn't know a lot about before embarking on this project. But it's a degree that focuses on improving human systems. So figuring out how people are working a manufacturing line and essentially trying to bring more efficiency to the work they're doing so that they can either make more computers coming off that line, or, you know, just do things in a quicker way that improve the costs of a business. And so when Steve Jobs finds Tim Cook, hires him away from Compaq in the late 1990s, Apple was on the brink of bankruptcy. It had a ton of inventory which Tim Cook refers to as quote unquote evil. He really saw it as evil, because if you have inventory on hand, especially in the computing business, you may not be able to sell it as fast as you're making improvements to the technology inside a computer, and it becomes outdated and you just have this sunk cost. So Tim Cook came in and revolutionized the operation side of Apple. He became kind of the left brain to Johnny Ive's right brain, and that And that was what allowed Apple to excel during the Steve Jobs era between 2000 and 2010, because it was just making products really efficiently that were tremendously popular. And that combination is what set Apple on its way.
And initially, Cook was setting up things more efficiently for Apple to ship these revolutionary products. But under Cook's leadership, there really haven't been many revolutionary products. There's been some great, there's been some good products, some would say great, but I don't think anyone would call it revolutionary. To what extent has that played a role in the impact of the Apple that we all know today?
Certainly what you've seen is kind of a shift from revolutionary to revolutionary innovation to incremental innovation at Apple over the past decade. What you see are, you know, annual updates to the iPhone that could slip by unnoticed, maybe mean you don't need to go buy one this year. But if you bought one in the past 3 years, when you open the camera and take a photograph, I mean, it borders on taking the photograph of you, right? The sophistication is there. It's just not something that smacks you upside the head like the first iPhone did. And that really has changed the way people perceive Apple, both internally and externally, in part because the company is not making those great leaps that it once did, but it hasn't diminished the popularity of the brand. Obviously, it's still, arguably the most successful company in the country, and remains, and it's increased its market valuation tremendously during the Tim Cook era.
I don't know. It's interesting when we were talking about it before the show. You sort of wonder whether it's going to become GM. In other words, that Apple has got this stable of products that's gotten very stable. And so you wonder, what are they going to do to innovate and move forward? We know they've moved into services. Talk a little bit about that and how that was guided by Tim Cook.
Yeah, that's really Tim Cook's masterstroke over the past decade, is that in the midst of looking for what product could come next and recognizing that the technological leaps to deliver something like an augmented reality headset or virtual reality glasses may be years off. Tim settled on a strategy of building more businesses on the back of the iPhone. And among those businesses that we've seen introduced are Apple Music, which was partly developed through an acquisition of Beats by Dre, the headset, and Beats Music, the app that had a catalog of music. And then building on the back of that, Apple's added Apple TV Plus, and it's added Apple Fitness. These are all businesses that Apple can then sell on a monthly basis and generate anywhere from $5 to $10 per app. That increases the revenue that comes into the company and is provides a new lifeblood of growth for the business, just by virtue of the fact that so many people have the iPhone.
Yeah, so it's got this distribution channel that it can push out to everybody, which is great for Apple as a company, but as far as the soul of the company, and really Johnny Ive's embodying that soul. These services have really played a role in diminishing Ive's role in the company. Talk to us about how that happened and how it impacted Ive's and what he's doing now.
Yeah, there's a scene in the book that speaks to that. Every year, Apple's top executives gather for an annual convention or annual business meeting. And during the course of that meeting, one of the heads of the services business stands up and shows a chart that's essentially an X-axis, with the upward line in the chart being services revenue that's coming in and services profit, and the downward line being hardware profit. And everyone who was sitting in the room said, oh, wow, we're really becoming a different company. You know, the company that Johnny Ive had essentially built that was all about making more iPhones or more iPads, et cetera, is not at the forefront of what we're doing. And for Johnny, this transition coincided with with a weariness that had set in, compounded by grief after Jobs' death, and compounded by frustration that within their efforts to make more hardware products, Apple was growing increasingly concerned about the cost of those products. And that was affecting the leaps that they could make with those products. So he withdrew. He stepped back from the company, and eventually he decided to depart fully in 2019. He now works with the company in a part-time role as a consultant with a new firm he set up called Love From that also works with companies such as Ferrari. But he's not there day to day. He's not as active as he once was.
Before we go, I'd like you to sort of talk about why is it that you believe that Apple has lost its soul? I mean, obviously that was an important point to you because it's why you titled the book.
Right, right. Well, really the subtitle speaks to two things. One, quite literally, Johnny Ive walks out of the company. He was considered by Steve Jobs to be a creative soulmate to Jobs. And, you know, therefore he was somewhat of the soul of the company. And then beyond that, he leaves. The reason he leaves is because Apple increasingly becomes a place where commerce dictates art, rather than one where art dictated commerce.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Fascinating conversation. Regular listeners know that I'm a huge Apple fanboy, so I really enjoyed our conversation. We've been speaking with Trip Mickel. He is the author of After Steve, How Apple Became a Trillion-Dollar Company and Lost Its Soul. As reported by KPCW's Carolyn Murray, the Bittner Ranch Road Connector project with the Silver Creek neighborhood is moving ahead despite one property owner's objections. The City Council voted last Wednesday to authorize the county attorney's office to file the complaint for eminent domain and to serve property owners Newton and Kimberly Collinson. Joining us this morning to help understand eminent domain is attorney J.D. Kessler with Parsons, Bailey & Latimer. Thank you for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me today.
So let's start off first. Eminent domain is something a lot of us have heard of, but probably really don't fully understand. Give us a short explanation of what eminent domain is and why it's important.
Yeah, well, eminent domain is important, you know, in some ways because it touches on so many of the basic things that we all care about. I mean, the case history, whether big or small, you know, touches on constitutional law, it touches on our private property rights, it touches on basic levels of fairness and what we value as a society. So eminent domain, interestingly, the name was first used by, or that term was first used by Hugo Grotius, a 17th century legal scholar. He was a Dutch legal scholar, very famous in international law. But he used it in the context of his natural law theories, which was a way to describe the concept that while historically the sovereign, the king, had taken any property he had wanted in some ways historically, but eminent domain was used to describe this concept that should only happen if you're compensated, if you're paid. Now, this concept goes back even a little bit further because the one that most people will recognize is the Magna Carta in 1215, when King John's barons, you know, sort of rose up to stand up against him and made him sign the Magna Carta. There was a clause in there that talked about how the king couldn't take their property unless they were paid timely and fair compensation. Apparently what had been happening is King John had been going and taking their lumber and, you know, taking their people, you know, to go fight in his battles and would say, yeah, I'll pay you. And, you know, the check's in the mail, I'll pay you later, right? And so obviously they didn't like that because, you know, payment delayed is really, you know, fairness and justice denied because these people then spend years trying to come up with this. So that's where it comes back to. And this idea of fairness is where, by the time the Constitution was written in 1787, the founders really had that ingrained in them. And so the Fifth Amendment included the clause that, you know, private property should not be taken for a public use without just compensation. And in some ways, that was just such a basic concept to them that there wasn't a whole lot of more detail put into it. A very simple concept to them. And that's continued today. Every state constitution has a similar clause to that. Utah's is slightly different. Article 1, Section 22 says that public, you know, private property should not be taken for a public use, should not be taken or damaged for a public use without just compensation.
So where has, here in Utah, have we had some sort of controversial cases about eminent domain that give us a sense for where the sticking points are when someone wants to do this?
You know, I think, yes, to a certain extent, every case that ends up being reported by the Utah Supreme Court, or really handled by the Utah Supreme Court, in some ways has some element of controversy to it. And, you know, for the parties involved, I mean, the landowners, they're always controversial because sure. this is your private property. This could be the parcel of land that your great-grandparents homesteaded. It could be the house that you raised your kids in. So these are very important issues to everyone involved. And so I think most people who are involved in these cases are sensitive to that, and you need to be very careful with them. As far as controversial cases, I mean, there's all sorts. I mean, I don't think there's many roads or public areas in the state you could go to that hasn't been touched somehow by eminent domain. You know, local here in Summit County, I can think of, I mean, I think there were 20 different landowners condemned for Jordan L. Reservoir. I know that I-80, numerous landowners were condemned for I-80 back when it was built. I think the area, there was one case I thought of over at near the junction of Highway 40 and Interstate 80, used to be called the Road Commission, now it would be UDOT, but the Road Commission had to condemn access because historically those roads, if you owned property right next to them, you could essentially drive off your property and drive right onto the highway. Well, now they're limited access highways, and so they condemned that access right, which historically had been a property right that those folks held. As far as other controversies, important constitutional questions always take some work because the term public use, the term just compensation are not exhaustive.
Yeah, and that's where I wanted to go next. It seems to me one issue is when is eminent domain properly exercised? What are the restrictions on government's ability? Can they do it for whatever frivolous or important reason they want? And the second issue that we'll eventually get to is compensation. But let's break it into pieces. Talk to us a little bit about what Utah courts have said about when is government allowed to use this?
So interestingly, in Utah specifically, the Utah Code defines what is a public use. Now, again, that is not a dictionary of lists. There are a lot, but as you go through that list, it is roads, it is school buildings, it is pipelines, it is natural gas storage wells, it is mining uses. And some of those are interesting because in the West, various states, Colorado, Utah, Montana, all, you know, included mining uses because in the 1880s that was so important to the state. And that's really eminent domain often goes to what we have decided to value as a society is what we will allow the use for. So what is a public use ends up being very important in a condemnation case because the condemnor, the city, the pipeline company, because sometimes they're not government entities, actually. They can be a mining company. They can be a pipeline company. But what they have to do is they have to show up and make a prima facie case to the court that they're using something that is a public use. So using the most basic examples, let's think of a road. Right off the bat, you would show up and you would have to put in your pleadings as the condemnor, this is a road, you know, this is a public road, this is going to be used for the public. Now, if I was, you know, condemning it for my own private use or access to a very limited purpose, there would be some controversy about that. But if it's, you know, State Street in Salt Lake County, it's pretty easy to say, look, having five lanes instead of four lanes is a public use. It's pretty easy to meet that burden. But that does come into it a lot. It would be, you know, that, and that's where a number of the cases over the years have gotten into those details, helping flesh out, you know, what is a, you know, is it, what is a building that's actually for a public use? There's been recent cases talking about procedure, but the other thing that Utah Code does that I think is really important, and I say this because if you go back maybe early 20th century, if anybody's ever read that Robert Caro book, The Power Broker, about Robert Moses. He went around building all those state parkways, and they would go out and bulldoze people's property for those roads prior to any sort of eminent domain action. And so Utah Code and most other states have clauses now that say, look, while it is allowed for you to go out and survey and study prior to an eminent domain action, in Utah now, if I want to condemn your land, I need to give you what it's called kind of the ombudsman notices. I kind of joke about it being the Miranda warning of condemnation because it says, dear landowner, we may use eminent domain and we have the right to, you have the right to an appraisal. You have the right to walk the property with our appraiser. You have the right to talk to the ombudsman's office. You have the right to just compensation, et cetera. And so you give those notices and then it has to be 30 days. If you're a city, there's certain limitations on, you have to have a public notice. Those folks need to have the opportunity to show up and, you know, discuss their property and, you know, contest it if they need to. So there's a lot of procedural hurdles that go into it to make sure that this is a public use and that it's being done, you know, with certain due process so that you're not just having you're not having Robert Moses just go out and bulldoze through your land and then saying, well, what are we going to do? There's already a road there.
So all those rights that property owners have, they don't have expertise in these areas to protect themselves. So who pays the cost to have the experts help the homeowner to defend and try to maintain their rights if they would like to?
So that's interesting. You know, you know, we follow the common law system that everybody pays their own costs in the U.S. And so now you do have the opportunity to get an appraisal through the ombudsman's office at the cost of the condemnor. So if the city is condemning for a road, they first pay for an appraisal and show it to you, and then you have the right to say, I want a second appraisal by someone I choose. You will pay for it, and then you can go to mediation at the ombudsman's office. But otherwise, for the most part, you know, attorney's fees, expert costs, those are on the landowner too.
So I guess the next big controversy is going to be how much. And so the ombudsman gets an appraisal. What kinds of principles are used to determine value? Is the appraiser going to be looking at current market values here in the community? How do they do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's, you know, first of all, appraisers, you know, all generally follow the USPAP standards. And so, and I cannot remember what those stand for at the moment. I should, but they follow those. And so you have a professional standard that they're supposed to follow. And when you're evaluating property, what you're trying to do is you are trying to determine what the hypothetical willing buyer and the hypothetical willing seller would negotiate for a transaction. Because it's clear, you know, that old saying, location, 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 when you need to build a road, that's a problem. And so they basically want to eliminate that idea from it to
the,
say
the leverage, right?
Yeah, the leverage. And so they want to try to have this be fair.
What about the concept of the highest and best use at that spot?
Yeah, and that's great too. So what I learned from an attorney early in my career, and he used to always tell me these stories about, well, this is how you explain it. Because people, you may be using your land as a cornfield. And you like it. Your grandparents homesteaded it, and it's wonderful. But it absolutely would be unfair for the appraiser to come in and say, well, what is a cornfield worth when next door there's a Walmart? And your property happens to be large enough that it could be a target. And so the highest and best use is used as a way to look at it, not to say what is the current use, but what would that hypothetical seller, or a hypothetical buyer really want to come in and do. And so they look at it to say, what is the future potential of this area? What is, you know, is this parcel a potential Walmart parcel? And would a developer come in and buy it for that? Or is it, you know, so, and now there are standards that come out of case law in the code that require you to, you know, look at what is feasible, economically feasible, and likely in the reasonable near future, et cetera. Because obviously, no one knows what the property is going to be used for 100 years from now. You do have to look at it kind of in a real-time situation.
As a practical matter, how do things like this usually progress? I would assume that before we get all the way to a vote like we had last week, that someone's been talking to someone and that there's been an effort to try to get them to agree. Is that typically how that plays out?
Yeah, that's statutorily required. You are obligated as the condemnor to negotiate in good faith with the landowner. So you are obligated to contact them, you know, work this through, give them an offer so that it's as open as possible prior to, you know, filing a condemnation action. And that's part of that process I talked about with the ombudsman letter. They want to make sure that you've negotiated, you've given them this warning, they have the opportunity to call the ombudsman and all of that before you get to a point that the city council is voting.
So the fact that we had a vote indicates to us that that process has probably been gone through, assuming they followed the rules. I think because it's a road, the likelihood of a complex litigation over whether it's a public use probably not going to be very big. So this is going to turn into a fight about valuation in all probability, isn't it?
Yes. I think most eminent domain cases end up being a fight over valuation.
Yeah. And how does that play out? How does what leverage does the landowner have, and how does the condemnor kind of fight against that? Give us some insight into how things like this typically play out.
So typically the process, so each side would have an appraiser, and the appraiser, you know, both would evaluate what they think the property is worth, and let's just assume the landowner's, you know, comes in higher than the condemnors, and then
I think we can assume that
the litigation will be over quick.
Exactly. If it's if it wasn't, there's not much to argue about. But and so ultimately, what happens is that is the testimony you would put on in front of the judge. You would put, you know, your as the landowner, you would put your appraiser on. And you'd put a typical witness is going to be the landowner. The landowner is going to get on, talk about their property, talk about, you know, everything they've done. And then the condemnor would also put on their appraiser. And it becomes a question for the jury to decide who do they think is more credible and what do they think is more reasonable. You know, appraisals are not necessarily a science. They're a little bit more of an art. And so, you know, that's why you often see them. It's very rare for them to come in really close. And like you said, if they come in really close together, the parties just sit down and negotiate and figure it out.
JD, how long does that process typically take?
Well, litigation is slow. And so it could take you a few years. And what happens is there is a process in Utah called the right to immediate occupancy. And so essentially what happens is the condemnor is able to file a motion that says, we need this for this public use and we need it now, or we need it, you know, soon. We can't wait 2 years for this condemnation to be completed. So the judge will make an order that says, okay, UDOT, for example, you have the right to come in, build your road, and meanwhile, we will have a separate trial about valuation. And so, you know, the project goes on, and, you know, for the public, you may see the road is done, you think it's done, you know, over, but it's all just being done under a occupancy order instead of anything final. And, you know, I've seen these drag out for years where I had a case where it was a pipeline case, and we, I think it was 7 years after the project was completed was when we finally, you know, settled the case.
Yeah.
Well, we've been speaking with attorney J.D. Kessler with Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, and unfortunately, it sounds like that's the road that we're going to be on here in Summit County, if you'll pardon the pun.
We have in the studio with us Tanatoli of the Red Banjo Pizza establishment on Main Street, a mainstay for many of us. It's probably Park City's oldest business, and it's celebrating 60 years of services to the community. Their doors have been open since the silver mining era, and since 1962, it's endured and thrived through our evolution. Joining us to talk about this impressive milestone. Good morning, Tana.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's set the stage. Tell us a little bit about the Red Banjo business when it first opened.
Sure. So my grandparents were Park City High graduates, and in 1962, they decided to open Red Banjo, and it was Red Banjo Saloon, and it started as a bar, and then in the 70s, it became a pizza restaurant.
So tell us about, one of the things that our listeners like to hear about is the history here of Park City. And what was it like as a bar? I mean, who went there? Tell us a little about the business.
Yeah, sure. So the first, actually, this is a great story my grandma tells. So the first 4th of July, which would have been in 1962 before the ski resorts opened, they served $400 worth of 10-cent beers. And at the time, there was only a couple of bars in Park City, and they actually didn't have music. So they were one of the first places to have live music, and they had our old-fashioned 4th of July parade, and then everyone came and had 10-cent beers. And so that's how it started. It had been a bar previously called the Park Tavern, and then when they bought it, they kept it as a bar. I remember even as a kid in the 80s still having bar tabs up on the wall, and there were miners, and there was people who would come in right out of the mine still in the early 70s and 80s, and they just had their bar tab and they'd pay it on Fridays. So it's kind of cool to remember that. And we still have the same original bar, the same original bar stools, the old cash register, and it actually worked, that old cash register, until I was probably 7 or 8.
So Tana, you mentioned your grandma and her telling that story. There's 4 generations of you now.
Yes.
Tell us who's all involved in Red Banjo.
Yeah. So actually, I just finished a hike with my grandmother, whose 85th birthday was yesterday. And then my nephew, who is her great-grandson, and he is 9. And so we just finished a hike. So there's my grandmother, my father, my stepmother, and then my brother. Carson and Donovan are my niece and nephew, and they're 6 and 9. And then my aunt Roxanne is also involved. And so we've remained a totally family in Park City and continue to live here.
And one of the things that's enabled you to keep prices reasonable on Main Street is the fact that you actually own the building, which is very unusual.
Yes, back then that was probably one of the best decisions my grandma made, and she does say that was buying the building, even though, you know, I won't tell you how much it was, but in today's prices, it would be like, wow, why wouldn't you? But it was difficult for them to buy it, and they did have to take out a loan, and they had worked really, really hard to pay it off. And one of the lessons my grandma always taught me was to pay extra every single month on your principal, so you could get it paid off, and so that it would always be yours, and that would be something that she could always pass on as a legacy to her family.
Talk to us a little bit about how the restaurant evolved from the bar to the pizza parlor.
Yeah, so it was a bar, like I said, at the beginning. And then in the 70s, pizza was up and coming in America. And she had 3 little kids. And she decided that as a single mom, she needed to do something that was different than a bar. So she opened a pizza restaurant. And I believe at the time, we just had the pizza, the salad, and maybe cheese bread, but we really only had 8 ingredients, and we really made everything out of the 8 ingredients. But it did take a few years to, you know, figure out that pizza recipe. And we have another side of our family. Her son Steven lives in Lava Hot Springs, and we have a couple of restaurants there and a few more businesses, but they also have a pizza restaurant there, and the recipe there is different than here because of the elevation. So it's all about the elevation, the flour, the yeast, all of that going into it.
Does your grandma have some good stories about some pizza customers? She shared some good stories about when it was a bar.
I'm sure she does. I just remember one, and I'll have to ask her those stories, but one gentleman was named Jack, and he would come in all the time and sit at the end of the bar, and I think he only could say like 4 or 5 words, really. He just kind of mumbled and didn't have a lot of teeth, but he was an old miner who lived up on Daly, and every day about 3 o'clock he'd come in for his Bud Light or whatever was on draft at the time and just sit there and have his beer and paid us. And he loved my little brother when my brother was a little kid, and you know, would let him wear his old hat. But he was this old miner, and he was a fun guy.
And when did you start working there?
When I was born, mm-hmm. like the day I was born, really. Probably when I was five, no joke. I would wait tables, and I was learned how to count back change, which is a lost art these days. And there were many people who would come in just to see me waiting tables, and they would call ahead and say, "Is that little girl gonna be the waitress today?" So I was learning how to spell, learning how to read, learning how to write, and going and waiting on the tables. And one of my grandma's favorite stories is that there was a group of guys who used to come in all the time after golfing, and they would have beer and pizza after they'd go out on the golf course. And it was Mother's Day, and I wrote on the back of their ticket, this is before POS systems, "Happy Mother's Day." And they thought that that was the funniest thing they'd ever heard, that this little girl would write Happy Mother's Day to them. So I think they tipped me $20. So.
It's so nice to have a family business on Main Street, right? Our town is changing so much. And over the next 20 years, it's going to continue to change. What do you hope Red Banjo Pizza looks like 20 years from now?
Well, I hope that we, as a Tolley family, maintain our legacy in Park City and maintain the true mom-and-pop character. And that's what I want to continue to see from Main Street. Every time we lose a mom-and-pop business on Main Street, it's a lot harder for them to come into business. And I really, really would love to strive to encourage more young entrepreneurs to open these small businesses that can be passed down through families. But I know that we're rare and there's few and far in between, but we do hope that we can at least inspire a younger generation to come in and try to continue to maintain that local, authentic character of Park City.
How are you still evolving? I understand that you've changed. You recently had a change in your liquor license status. Tell me about what you plan to do to change things for the better in
sure.
the business.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So during COVID, obviously we didn't know what was going to happen, and we went from just serving beer and wine to having a full liquor license, which has been extremely helpful. We're not necessarily a place people think of going and like having a few cocktails, but it does. If you do want to go have a beer and you would prefer to have, you know, alcohol versus beer, this gives you the option to do that.
Back to your roots.
Yeah.
Back to being a bar.
Exactly. And then we did, actually, during COVID, we started keeping out the dining outside during the winter with heaters. And so we'll continue to maintain to do that. I've also started doing quite a few local and corporate parties where you can rent the restaurant and have like a Western themed party. And you're right next to the Egyptian. We have a deck that has that marquee. You can see the marquee. It's a very Instagrammable moment. We've done some wedding parties. We've done some rehearsal dinners, and just trying to evolve into what the next era looks like. We always want to remain family friendly. And so even though there's a lot of people who are upping their prices and really trying to maybe make a little more than because of the times we're in, we don't want to do that. We want to maintain that we are a place you can come to and you feel the family experience, but you don't pay an arm and a leg for it.
And you mentioned COVID. Obviously, to be in business for 60 years, you've navigated some challenging times. Tell us about another challenging time, maybe from your grandmother's era.
Oh, well, there's a lot of challenging times. I think over 60 years, you've seen every up and down and ebb and flow. And I always laugh that maybe laugh is the wrong word, but there's a lot of people who come to town and think it's always like Sundance, and it's not. And for those of us who have been in business long enough to realize that there were mud seasons that were really, really, really slow. And there were days where you would have one or two customers. And there were times where, you know, it was either pay your property taxes or have Christmas. And sometimes those are the ways it was in Park City. And it wasn't always a thriving mountain town, you know, even into the 90s and into the 2000s. So I would say what's, you know, kept us in business is just being able to have that grit and be able to evolve to what the environment looks like and what the economy looks like. But I will say that one thing about pizza is I think it's recession proof. That's what we're finding. During 2008, I came back from living in California for a couple years with my now ex-husband, and we took over the restaurant for 5 years. But during that time, I was so worried that we were going to have this, what are we going to do? The restaurant's, you know, going to go out of business. And people still came to town. They just weren't eating fine dining every night. They were eating pizza, but they were still skiing. So I think that pizza might be recession-proof.
Before we go, let's just talk about the other things you have on the menu besides pizza as the restaurant's evolved, just real briefly.
Sure. So we have, I think now we have 9 sandwiches, all hot sandwiches. We do 9 salads, including like a spinach watermelon salad. And then what I really has been very popular is diversifying our crust. So we have a gluten-free option. We have a cauliflower option that is gluten-free and is my favorite. And then I recently added a keto option, which is made of chicken. And it's a crispy chicken. And so if you're on a no-carb diet, you can actually do this with the cheese and the pepperoni. And then besides that, we also do a variety of pasta dishes as well.
Okay, well, great. Congratulations again on 60 years here in Park City. The community is lucky to have you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.